Hi, everyone. Welcome to Oscar Wilde, a podcast about film, always counting down to next year's Oscars. I'm Nick Werkraut.
And I'm Sophia Simonello.
And today we have a very fun episode. We've teased about talking about Materialists, Celine Song's newest movie out in theaters now. I'm very excited to talk about this. We'll review the film, talk about how it's done opening weekend, and hear both of our reactions. And then we'll give some of our early Oscar predictions. It is, again, very early, but I think we will have some fun talking about predictions in all of the acting categories, Best Director, Best Picture, and for the first time ever at the Oscars, Best Casting. So we'll talk about that at the end, but I'm excited to see how these turn out for both of us as well.
Yeah, me too. I always love this episode every year because we just have fun with them. We hope that our favorites can last all season long. We, you know, make some bold predictions here or there. If you listen to previous episodes, you can definitely hear some of those. But I'm also really excited to talk about Materialists, Celine Song's follow-up to Past Lives, which we were both really big fans of. So I think let's just start right there. We'll do a pretty quick review before we jump into our predictions, but description here: a young, ambitious New York City matchmaker finds herself torn between the perfect match and her imperfect ex. This was directed and written by Celine Song and stars Dakota Johnson, Pedro Pascal, and Chris Evans. With a $12 million opening, it became A24's third biggest opening ever, behind Hereditary with $13.5 million and Civil War with $25.5 million. So there's definitely, I think, an appetite for this movie from audiences. I think so far the marketing has been pretty great. It's been everywhere, all over social media, but I think it's selling a different kind of movie than what we're actually getting in the theater, which is pretty interesting. So I'll start with you. What did you think of Materialists?
We should also like title this pod or challenge each other during this pod to not mention Past Lives. I think that is a lot of what I base my expectations on going into this. I have loved its campaign so far. I love seeing Dakota Johnson on Hot Ones and all of their press tour interviews. I think there is such a need and a want for glitzier rom-coms. And this, from the outset, with these actors, these beautiful, talented actors that we've known from many other projects now, really set the stage for that. And I was a fan of, I would probably say, at least the movie's first half. Mm-hmm. I have some issues with its second half or final act, I would say. I think it starts to get a bit cheesy at the end, and I'm also famously not a big fan of rom-coms overall, so take that into account, but I think it just goes overboard. And for the movie or the trailer, I would say going into it, it's like, oh, is she gonna pick the really hot rich guy, or is she gonna go with the guy who knows her drink order is a beer and a Coke, and he's a little scruffier and rough around the edges, but he's kind of her like childhood love. And I think this is more or less pretty common for certain rom-coms. So I was expecting her to maybe take it in a different direction or to show us a new kind of rom-com. And maybe she does, and you can explain because of what you said earlier about subverting expectations or not really what audiences expected, but I kind of left just disappointed. Mm-hmm. I wanted more, and we can talk about all of that too, but what did you think?
I really liked it, and I think what I really liked about it was that it was very different than Past Lives. Now, I know you challenged me not to say it, and I already have, but I think that what works about that film so well is totally absent from Materialists, for better or for worse. And we can talk about that, I think, with the writing of the film. But I think what I really enjoyed about it was just how I felt. It was very mean and honest about how people today date, especially in big cities. I think one of my favorite details, so Lucy, she works for this matchmaking company called Adore Matchmaking, which is this, you know, very boutique, bespoke, high-end experience. But as you look at the offices, they reminded me a lot of companies like Glossier or failed companies, even like The Wing, where they're just designed with the millennial woman who wants to spend too much money on herself, whatever that means, in mind. And when you look more closely, it's a really cheap good and things are falling apart. And I thought that was a really interesting thing to think about, especially in a city like New York. You know, who are the people who are seeking out this service and why do they feel entitled to the perfect person for them? And why is the perfect person for them defined by superficial qualities? There are so many great lines, I think, as Lucy is meeting these clients. We have a man who says that he won't date a woman who is 39 because 39 is actually 40s. That's not 30s. There is an obsession with height over and over again in this movie, specifically as it pertains to the men. You know, is he actually 5'11 or is he lying about that? And I think what's great about that is that that is what people think of now, especially as people are meeting people through dating apps. And there's even, you know, a hierarchy of apps too. Like, are you on Raya or Hinge or Grindr or Tinder or whatever it is? Like, there's a different, you know, experience from each of those. But it, I think, really encourages people to seek out a partner for superficial qualities. You have your height listed there, your age, you know, all those things. I think all those numbers, I like how Celine Song then translates that into math, which actually, you know, you're calling it a rom-com, but it reminded me a lot of Jane Austen in how, which also might explain why you didn't like it as much, but like in Pride and Prejudice, when you think about Elizabeth Bennet, when you think about the Bennet sisters, like marriage is a business deal. It is about money. It's about setting yourself up for a better future. And it's why Mrs. Bennet is so obsessed with getting those girls out of the house and married. It has nothing to do with love. And so I think I, in that vein then, expected and was hopeful that it might follow that train a little bit, that it might be like a modern play on the Victorian novel a little bit, or some of these great British novels. But it ended up, I think, playing out a little bit differently. It also reminded me of another movie that I'm a big fan of that you are not a fan of, and that is James L. Brooks's Broadcast News, which is another corporate-focused or centered story about this woman and these two very different men. And I thought about that movie a lot as I was watching it. I also thought about Working Girl, just because Dakota Johnson's mom, Melanie Griffith, is in that. And that's, I think, also just about a woman who is really good at her job, but also is navigating love and romance at the same time. So yeah, I think it reminded me of a lot of films that I really like. And I thought it was just very, it was a very refreshingly honest, modern take on how people are thinking about dating now. Do I think it's perfect? No. I did have some issues with the script at times, but I have to say, I think sometimes seeing three really hot people interact on screen is enough. And that's how I felt sometimes when I was watching this movie. I was just like, yeah, you know, I like watching Dakota Johnson and Pedro Pascal on a date. Is their dialogue ridiculous and made up of phrases that no human would ever say? Yes. Am I enjoying it still? Also, yes.
Well, let's start there, because I didn't dislike everything about this movie. That is a common trope of rom-coms, and that is fine, because I also enjoyed watching them all interact. Was I distracted by wondering if Chris Evans was wearing a wig the whole time? Possibly. But I enjoyed the banter between Lucy and Harry, It's just that no one in this movie had any chemistry, and that was what was difficult to take in.
Yeah.
You know, I love that everyone is obsessed with Pedro Pascal. For me, that didn't necessarily work. Is that a problem with, like, can gay actors play straight roles now? I don't think that's the conversation we need to be having, because that's also not true. But I just could never buy into it. And whether that was just their chemistry or not, that's just the bottom line for me. And the same thing with Chris Evans. I just couldn't see them being in this relationship. We don't even have to get into all of their problems or complications. I am also not going to date someone who's 37 and living with two roommates and walks outside and steps on a dirty floor where you have visible trash and your bathroom mirror doesn't close fully shut. And it's just all of these things that I understand love and what you should do for it, but that's a huge red flag. So I also think he was just miscast, but I'm also wondering, like, does the story only work because it's someone like him that we know that is gorgeous, that has had such a fruitful career? I just had trouble buying into parts of the story that we had to rely on. So I think that's my casting issue. How do you feel about that part of the movie? Because again, you liked it. Was that an issue for you or something you could overcome?
Well, I think there are two separate things going on here, so we can break them down a little bit, like with Harry, the Pedro Pascal character, and with John, the Chris Evans character. And I think we're going to put a little spoiler warning here, just a light spoiler warning. I know people have probably had a chance to see this, but we are going to be getting into some spoilers here. So if you don't want to hear that, we have timestamps. Go to our Oscar prediction section. Come back later after you've seen Materialist. Okay, so let's get into Harry first and the lack of chemistry. So I think that this is partially purposeful because I agree. I personally did not feel like they had great chemistry either. And what's odd is, to me, Pedro can have chemistry with anyone. Like, he's the type of person who could have chemistry with the wall. Like, that is just, you know, who he is, like, with people interviewing him, with his co-stars. Mm-hmm. That's just the type of actor that he is. And Dakota Johnson, I think, brings, you know, a very particular aura to all of her movies, which is just this cool girl who I think can also have chemistry with actors, but is a little bit more pulled back. And what I thought was going on there that was interesting, at least, was that their relationship really starts as a business deal. She thinks that he would be great for her company. She thinks that he would be a really good match for her clients. So it's this little back and forth where she's trying to decide, I think at first, whether or not this is someone she wants to pursue something with, as she says. And, you know, he's what their company calls a unicorn. He makes a ton of money. He's hot. He's nice, well-educated, all of that. And so for her, if she dates him herself, yes, she could marry a rich guy, but also she's losing out on something potentially at work. So I think that's interesting. And for me, that all clicked when she goes into his $12 million apartment and she has more chemistry with the apartment than the man, because that felt so real to me. Like, that just felt very real for this person who thinks about money all the time and who thinks about relationships as currency all the time. She would see that apartment, anyone would, I think, and would possibly be more drawn to that. I know I would. I would just want to look around that apartment. I thought that was hilarious. So I feel like, though, their relationship does escalate without evolving in a way that I think would throw people, because, yeah, you don't really see their chemistry progress in any way where you would believe that they are in love, but they're also never really supposed to be. So I don't know. I think that's also a tricky one because, yeah, their relationship is all transactional. So I would have liked them to have more chemistry too, just because it would have been more fun to watch. But at the same time, I think there's something interesting going on there between the two of them and what type of relationship that is. The John character. So this is where I had trouble suspending my disbelief, because he has not changed one bit since they broke up. So on their 5-year anniversary, they had this huge fight. She was yelling at him in the streets about money. Their breakup came down to money. And it's hard for me to believe that a woman who had spent that much time focused on how marriage and how relationships, how money is important in them, would suddenly go back to her ex when he hadn't changed at all. I thought that was a difficult thing in the character. Now, I understand there's also a huge dramatic thing that happens with one of the other characters, with one of her clients. But that to me was just like a very unrealistic romance detail. Because I don't think, and this is the last comparison I'll make to Past Lives, I promise. I think Past Lives' strength was also just in how she, I think, set up without a ton of backstory, but because of the structure of her script and her story, we were able to understand so much about Nora and so much about Hae-sung that when they came together in the present, everything clicked, all the decisions made sense. And then I think the pain and the heartbreak felt more intense and real. And here, I don't think we know enough about Lucy and John as a couple to make it entirely believable that suddenly she's kind of throwing away all of her ideas that she has around marriage and money and just pursuing love. How are we to know that it's not going to go down the exact same path that it did before? So I agree with you on that point. I think that was the one for me where I did struggle a little bit to understand why she would make that choice. Just the why the character would make that choice, because I don't think enough was done there to show that. However, I did love their scenes together. I think Chris Evans is such a good romantic lead. I want him in more things because I feel like he really sold the yearning, and I love yearning in films. Wong Kar-wai does it best. But I think that here, like, I think he did a really great job there and took me back to not the golden age of the screwball comedy or those sorts of romantic dramas, but the ones that I grew up with. Like, he could have fit right into How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days or one of those types of movies. It just made me nostalgic, I think, for that.
Yeah, it's just this crazy thing for me where all of the shots of them kissing, both couples, was like 10 out of 10 fire. But then there was nothing behind it. I was confused, or it just didn't feel natural. So it's an odd feeling to have with, again, this selection of actors.
Yeah. It's funny that you say that, though, because I think everyone I've talked to has had such a different response to the actors in this movie. Like, I told a friend, Chris Evans is great in this. You will love Chris Evans in this. She left the movie and told me she thought Dakota Johnson and Chris Evans had brother-sister energy. So I think people are really, they're experiencing it and interpreting it in very different ways. I think it is kind of a test, like, to see who you fall in line with or where you end up personally, like who you would choose. I am kind of glad, though, that we didn't get one of those movies where she just chooses herself. I think I would have groaned and eye rolled a little bit. I did like that it had the romance at the end.
Well, what I told my friend after I saw this was, I was like, it was okay. But I think this is like the follow-up to How to Be Single.
Oh my God.
Like, it is definitely the sister film where I still felt like Dakota Johnson was portraying a similar person.
I saw Madame Web vibes too.
So maybe it just speaks to Dakota Johnson. Yeah. But there are so many parallels. I mean, she really is just being so much herself in all of these movies. We get her banter. And the one thing for her I couldn't buy into for Lucy was that, you know, she's this really confident businesswoman. And no matter how these dates go that she plans for her clients, even if they don't work out, like in the very beginning, we see her meeting with Sophie and she goes, well, he didn't like you enough for a second date, but I do have this other really great guy. And she kind of, she knows how to spin it. And obviously that makes a good business person, but she's always positive that there is something around the corner if it doesn't work out. But then for herself, she calls herself a failed actress and she reuses lines that her clients use. Like when Harry asks her at dinner, what do you like about me or something to that effect? And she's like, you make me feel valuable, which someone else had said earlier. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how do you not have as much self-confidence in yourself that you do when you're working for somebody else? And I can kind of relate to that. I feel that. But
yeah,
she also like doesn't believe in herself enough to know that love or emotion is a part of the equation. It's not pure math. And that is love. And that's obviously what she went through with John previously. It's like they were in love, but the money wasn't there. So it's like, how does she not see this to a frustrating level that I kind of wanted her to end up alone? Because it's like, you need to have enough self-worth to like survive in this city. If you're making $80,000 pre-tax, that is insane. That can't be real.
Mm-hmm. Her apartment's too nice. I know.
A wardrobe like that, an apartment where it is and what it is.
One bedroom. Yeah, that was not happening.
No. I mean, for all of the good writing, and I agree there were some great one-liners in the first act of us getting into this mindset that love is a monetized exchange, and there is some ugliness in that, but there was a lot of, yeah, shakiness for me.
I just felt like you were my therapist just now, because I just really related to her, because I think it's so much easier to sell something to someone else than to sell it to yourself. Because she, for me, she doesn't totally buy any of it, what she's saying. I mean, look at how she talks about her clients when it's just to her coworkers. She rolls her eyes. She knows that she's kind of like Mother Superiorum. Like, she's just selling them something. She's putting them under a spell. I think of her at the wedding when she's talking to all those women and she's like, you're looking for a grave buddy. Like that, she's yeah, being funny. Like, she is selling them an idea that I don't think she totally believes in anymore. And I think she's fully pivoted to not believing in love in the same way and to just believing in it as a business deal. And I think that the catalyst of that really was her failed relationship with John and realizing how much fighting over money really broke her and broke that relationship. And now she says to Harry, well, the next guy I date, I'm going to marry. I don't think she has low self-worth. I think that she is just jaded and a bit disillusioned. And she knows what she has to do to succeed at work. And that is basically being a saleswoman, selling an experience that she knows people want to believe in. What is that line at the wedding when she's talking to that bride who doesn't know if she wants to go through with it? And she's like, my parents spent hundreds of thousands of dollars just for me to feel like a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Those sorts of lines, I think, in the movie really show what Celine Song is playing with. And I don't know. I feel like the Lucy character, yeah, she's just a little bit cynical. And I think she's gotten very probably comfortable in how she views love and in making it happen for other people. So she doesn't have to do it for herself.
And I think that's okay to be in that place, but does that mean she has to decide in this moment? I mean, I get that it's a movie, but
yeah,
like if she's not ready or if the options aren't right for her, she doesn't have to say yes again when, again, he hasn't changed at all. We can get right off of this topic, but it's just like, I don't know. I expected maybe Celine Song to, again, say something differently.
Mm-hmm.
This all comes back to the framing of the movie, which was a dream Lucy has. And it's how we open the film on these cave people. And I was like, oh boy, we are opening the film on a silent sequence of a caveman and a cavewoman. And from here, we understand that, you know, no matter the place, love will always mean more than money. And he gets her a bouquet of these wildflowers that he makes into a ring. And she adores him for this. And obviously, times were much simpler then. But I love her quick edit to New York and how a lot of things have changed, but the essence of love and finding your person, finding your grave buddy, really hasn't. And that's the romance of it all. That is a common trope also. So again, to frame it this way, I was like, okay, great. I know what's coming. And to me, I love a movie that does something unexpected. And this was definitely that. I wasn't like put off by it, but I think for what it became and that it wasn't used, I think, in a way to change our minds mm-hmm. or to make us see love in a different way. I think that's my difficulty with it. It also played into one of, I think, three different endings we didn't need. After every like fade to black, I'm like, okay. And then we keep going. I'm like, okay, this is the one. And for a movie that, again, you're saying is so mean and ends on such a high note, it wasn't whiplash. I don't want to say that, but I think it begged for less to be questioned.
I do think it is tonally confused at times. I think that there are, I felt at least that there were two different movies happening. Mm-hmm. And I did feel like that as we got to the end in particular. And on the cave people point, I actually rolled my eyes very hard at the beginning. I thought, oh no, this is what we're in for. I don't think I can do this. It just felt very on the nose. And mm-hmm. also like you talking about love having, you know, always been there and everything. For me, I was viewing it as he's providing, like he's a hunter-gatherer. He's taking care of her. It's this, you know, it kind of combined those ideas a little bit. But I did wonder why she went there. But then I very quickly, as soon as we got to New York, settled right into it. I think it is a very fun New York movie. I love just seeing the city. I think the music is great. It, you know, casts New York in this really beautiful light, like Celine song. Now she's 2 for 2 in doing that. Birdie's great bar in Bushwick, where they go after John's play. But yeah, I would recommend seeing it really just to have a conversation about it. I do think it is a very unique and interesting look at what dating is like now. So I would recommend it.
I think I would recommend it too. I'm a bit more hesitant, but again, at least at this point, I'm not going to not see a Celine Song movie. I think she's mm-hmm. a great writer and director. There are a lot of like filmic parallels to Past Lives, which I really liked. Just things that reminded me of that movie apart from Easter eggs in the film. But A24 also released a materialist's movie syllabus that Celine Song put together. I wanted to mention this earlier because it is very much Screaming Sophia and not Nick. And Broadcast News is on this. Age of Innocence, James Ivory, Mike Lee, Robert Altman. Again, look at this list, Phantom Thread. So not necessarily all movies I don't like, but definitely movies that you praise time and again.
Mm-hmm. For my fellow Threadheads, my fellow Phantom Thread lovers, Celine Song takes a line from Phantom Thread and gender flips it here. She describes Lucy as a confirmed bachelorette. And if you're a fan of Phantom Thread, you'll remember that Reynolds, when he and Alma are sitting by the fire at their first date, he says, "I'm a confirmed bachelor." So Reynolds and Lucy, they have so much in common.
Maybe they would end up together. I could absolutely see Lucy, but more so just Dakota Johnson cooking some foul mushrooms for him.
She would poison him on purpose. Absolutely. She would not put up with him being a baby.
Well, that's a perfect segue into our Oscar predictions. Again, we'll go through all the acting categories first, and then director, picture, and casting. Let's dive right into it. So for supporting actress, my predicted nominees are Michaela Cole for Mother Mary, Laura Dern for J. Kelly, America Ferrera for The Lost Bus, Gabby Hoffman for Deliver Me From Nowhere, and Teyana Taylor for One Battle After Another.
So the reason why I love this episode is that no one knows anything. We have one in common. So we both have Laura Dern for J. Kelly, which is the new Noah Baumbach film that will be released by Netflix, I think should have a healthy fall festival run. She is a previous winner, so I think that's probably why we both have her here, too. And Netflix is very good at getting nominations. My other predicted nominees, I have Emily Blunt for The Smashing Machine, Elle Fanning for Sentimental Value, Ariana Grande for Wicked for Good, and Gwyneth Paltrow for Mardi Supreme. What a weird list I think that I have, like, now that I'm saying them out loud. Truly, what's going on? I don't know what to make of Wicked for Good. I just put Ariana Grande here because she's going to have a bigger role. I think it's going to be potentially even worse category fraud this time around, putting her in supporting, but I put her here just because I think last year she was probably the runner-up in that category. It just depends on how much people like it. You know, if Wicked last year, if that was just a novelty and they don't really care about part two, that's very possible. Or they could love it just the same when it comes to nominations. Act two, though, is not act one. Act one, the songs are a lot better. I think the story is stronger. So I'm really curious about that. But I just put her here mostly because I'm at that point where I'm just not sure.
They could change it up and put both of them in lead for how people felt about Ariana being in supporting last year. They could flip it also, but I think they both have big roles in the second film coming up. We could see the Academy, totally flub it just for being a sequel and, you know, saying this looks like the same movie, like based on the trailer we got already.
Mm-hmm.
I did also want to put in Gwyneth Paltrow for Mardi Supreme. It's from Josh Safdie, so they're splitting up here for this film cycle, at least, where Benny has The Smashing Machine. So you can talk about Emily Blunt maybe for a second. But in all of my research, I found Emily Blunt is going to be in a 2026 movie made and written by Steven Spielberg, also with Josh O'Connor and Coleman Domingo. And I was like, oh my God, I'm already excited for next year and we've barely gotten anything from this year. Let's see. So yeah, we talked about Laura Dern. I think the one I'm not really sure about is Michaela Cole. Mother Mary is an A24 movie. It's also starring Anne Hathaway. I did want to put her in for actress later on, but I kind of took her out because I don't know if this movie's coming out this year yet. A24, as always, has quite a number of films being released. And, you know, one of our first questions last year was, how are these studios with 5 to 10 at the higher end films going to rightfully campaign for everyone across the board? And, you know, now that the season is over, we saw that they just can't do that. So maybe they'll hold on to this one. Michaela Cole is a great creator as well, but I really want her acting skills to be appreciated too.
This is also the David Lowery film, and I love his movies, so that is really exciting to me, just seeing him directing Michaela Cole, who I'm also a big fan of, and Anne Hathaway. Yeah, I'm eagerly anticipating this one. It's just a matter of when is it coming. Talk to me about America Ferrera and The Lost Bus.
So this movie is being released by Apple, and it also stars Matthew McConaughey. This is directed by Paul Greengrass and is about a true story. It's based on the book Paradise, One Town's Struggle to Survive an American Wildfire. And I think if that's the only thing you know, especially after the wildfires that affected Los Angeles and the surrounding areas earlier this year, I think it really could speak to voters. And despite it being about a 2018 fire, is still very timely. So I don't know how this is going to play. There are a few stills out from the movie, so the tagline for today's episode, I don't really know. A big thing I should have put at the top too is just, I wanted to mention different names apart from us having like 4 out of the 5 same people who have won Cannes Awards or, you know, had a lot of press out of that festival or something like that. So maybe Matthew McConaughey has a chance. Maybe Paul Greengrass has a chance in directing. But at this point, I'm just looking for new movies than like the 10 we know about and have been excited for.
I mean, I think this is potentially a really good pick. It also has campaign extraordinaire producer Jamie Lee Curtis attached to it, so you know it's going to be everywhere, and she's going to be starting a grassroots campaign for the Lost Bus wherever she can throughout LA. So I don't know, and I think you're right about the timely topic. It's a filmmaker who also has been nominated before. America Ferrera was nominated for Barbie. Matthew McConaughey's a previous winner, so I don't know. I think it's very possible.
Jamie Lee Curtis driving a school bus around LA.
You say it jokingly, but
she is the David Lynch of our generation, which is the same generation.
That's so cursed. I need. Okay, I'm moving on to my list quickly. I had to put Gwyneth here mostly because I just want to be able to talk about Gwyneth this award season. Previous Best Actress winner. And I think Marty Supreme could be a really big deal. I think when Timothée Chalamet has a movie that comes out at Christmas, it can surge at the right time. And I don't know much about Gwyneth's role yet, but I could just see her breaking in here. I had a hard time with supporting actress, truly. But I don't know. I think this is one of those cases where I want it to happen and it feels likely. So I put her in. Elle Fanning for Sentimental Value. This is definitely more in the Hope Diction camp, but I think, you know, seeing Sentimental Value at Cannes, I was a big fan of this performance, and she has a number of scenes opposite Stellan Skarsgård, who I think is a big contender and supporting actor, and I think that sometimes can benefit actors when it comes to getting nominations. So I have her here. It would be a really cool first nomination for her. She's also playing an actress, and sometimes that works too. But I think the one I'm most confident in is Emily Blunt for The Smashing Machine, the Benny Safdie film coming out this year. And I will tell you exactly why. When I first saw her in this trailer, three words popped into my head. Melissa Leo, consider. I just saw her and thought of Melissa Leo in The Fighter. I don't think these roles are similar, but I saw the wig, I saw the nails, the jewelry, and I thought, here we go again. Mm-hmm. Emily Blunt coming off of an Oscar nomination 2 years ago for Oppenheimer. She didn't win for that movie, but I think she's an actress who has a lot of goodwill around her, and I could see this being a role that actors could really like. She's an accent. They also love a wife role. And from the trailer alone, I think she's going to have some emotional moments.
I didn't even know there was a trailer out yet. I think I'm avoiding this because I wasn't a big fan of The Fighter. And the fact that I previously confused this with being a Darren Aronofsky film, I'm kind of surprised he's not producing or in any capacity. But now I'm realizing that that was David O. Russell, and I'm thinking of The Wrestler with Mickey Rourke and how all of those movies just kind of seem like the same thing to me. I think it's definitely possible. Yeah, Emily Blunt, like I said, she's been around. She has a lot coming. My other two are Gabby Hoffman in Deliver Me From Nowhere. So this is a biopic about Bruce Springsteen, and Gabby plays his mom. And I think any role, you know, even if we're just thinking about A Complete Unknown and Timmy portraying a similar iconic character, if this gets any amount of love that that had, then we'll be talking about this in big categories. And, you know, apart from other supporting performances in the movie, which we can get to later on, and leading, this could be a potential. And my other one being Teyana Taylor. This is a trailer I have seen multiple times, and she just kicks ass in the trailer. I'm excited to see her. She had a big run through the award season a couple years ago for 1001. It was a smaller film, but everyone loved her. So I'm excited to see her have a role like this. You know, a pregnant mother shooting a gun is not something you see on the big screen every day. So it's fierce performance. Mm-hmm. And also that movie we might be talking about quite a bit.
Yeah, definitely. And I want to put Teyana Taylor in. It's just one of those things with PTA movies where I just never know how big the role is actually going to be until I see the movie. Mm-hmm. But I love that pick, and I can't wait to see her in that. Okay, so let's move on to supporting actor. I have Stephen Graham from Deliver Me From Nowhere, Sean Penn for One Battle After Another, Adam Sandler for Jay Kelly, Andrew Scott for Blue Moon, and Stellan Skarsgård for Sentimental Value.
We are 2 for 5. I also have Andrew Scott and Stellan Skarsgård, but I also have, and this is mainly for you, Jacob Elordi in Frankenstein playing the monster, Andrew Garfield in After the Hunt, and Benicio del Toro in One Battle After Another.
Those were all for me. Thank you. Thanks for those picks. Let's talk about our two we have in common. So we have Andrew Scott for Blue Moon and Stellan Skarsgård for Sentimental Value. Andrew Scott in Blue Moon. This is one of two Richard Linklater films coming out this year. This is about Rodgers and Hammerstein. And he won supporting actor at Berlin. So he already has one win under his belt. And he's playing Richard Rodgers. So I think this could be really exciting. Sony Pictures Classics doesn't have a whole lot on their slate this year, and they can really campaign, especially when it comes to getting actors in. And he was, you know, unfortunately completely robbed the year of All of Us Strangers, where he would have been my winner that year, but he didn't even get a nomination. So I'm hoping that this one will work out for him. And then Stellan Skarsgård, one of my favorite performances that I saw at Cannes, he, in this movie, is playing a director who is trying to make this film to reconnect with his daughter. And it's just a really beautiful, layered performance that has so many qualities to it that I think actors will really like.
That just made me think of Cinema Paradiso, and it made me so excited.
Aww.
So I, you know, with the praise from Cannes about this entire film, I just really hope everything can happen, from Stellan to Best Picture, which we'll talk about later. With Andrew Scott, I also saw the Berlin win. This is, I would say, Sony Pictures Classics as of now, like their biggest contender type of film. I'll mention Ethan Hawke in a bit, potentially, and Margaret Qualley also co-stars in this. I almost put her in after we almost saw her with The Substance. So we'll see how this movie does. Jacob Elordi in Frankenstein. So this adaptation is being made by Guillermo del Toro, and all I really think about, or try to with awardsy films by him, is The Shape of Water. I don't know. I'm just hoping it's, you know, the next flashiest movie that really gets some really good performances out of it, and that it really enlivens this material that we've seen over and over and over. We talked about Mel Brooks's Young Frankenstein before, and Gene Wilder, and I'm very curious about what he could do here.
I love that Jacob Elordi is playing the monster. Very excited to see what he can do with that large physical frame of his. It's interesting because I think Hollywood is definitely seeing a moment with monster movies again. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering with Frankenstein, is this going to be a, you know, Crimson Peak type of, which I actually love that movie, but just a very like highly stylized gothic film, or like a Nosferatu even, where it's very beautiful, very embraced, but it just sticks with below the line? Or is it a Poor Things, which is a Frankenstein story, where we just see it dominate across the board with acting nominations, picture and director, screenplay, like everything you can imagine, it gets in. So I don't know. I'm curious to see how it goes, though, but I think Netflix will push it very hard.
Yeah, I think this is one of Netflix's biggest movies, and that's kind of where I'm at right now, apart from Jay Kelly, which you have Adam Sandler for. Mm-hmm. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think with Adam Sandler here, this is going to be one of those acting nominations that Netflix really does try to push. I think he has a career narrative behind him, which can really benefit some actors. I think he also got close with Uncut Gems. I think he picked up some critics' prizes there. So I could see this being one that potentially some people do coalesce around. And the hard part is just with a movie like that, with multiple performances that, you know, are really big. We could talk about George Clooney later on. He's the lead, but we talked about Laura Dern already. Like, could this be a case like Laura Dern in Marriage Story where people just focus on this one performance as what's going to perform really well throughout award season? So for me, it just feels like one of those nominations that Netflix can pick up. And I think he's also a good campaigner, too. Like, I can see him doing Q&As and attending roundtables and just being really game for all of it. So that's why I have him here.
He came really close for Punch Drunk Love, too. There are just so many actors in this movie. So it's led by George Clooney. It has Adam Sandler, Laura Dern, Isla Fisher, Patrick Wilson, Emily Mortimer, Riley Keough, Billy Crudup, and more. So it's just, I don't know what all these characters are doing. If it's mainly George and Adam, then there's definitely some potential, especially with Baumbach, who is a talky writer. Mm-hmm. So I think it's definitely possible, especially if it's a more dramatic turn. We also have Happy Gilmore 2 coming out this year. So with multiple projects, maybe that will keep him in people's minds also. With Andrew Garfield and After the Hunt, this is a movie we've probably mentioned the most so far out of our upcoming slate. Luca Guadagnino directing, Andrew Garfield, Ayoa Debbie, and Julia Roberts. I don't know if he's playing someone who has assaulted somebody else. It's very vague by the premise, which is fine. I don't need to know everything yet about this movie. And also, I don't know if he's a lead or supporting. I kind of put him here because with Julia leading the film, it feels more likely that she'll be in lead, and potentially Andrew and Ayo will be in supporting with more of the cast, Michael Stuhlbarg and Chloe Sevigny. Again, I don't know, but I would love to see multiple people, especially in a Luca project, getting recognized for that.
And that is why I don't have After the Hunt anywhere in my nominations today. I have been burned previously here. Like, we have, again, another Amazon MGM Studios release of a Luca Guadagnino film. That was the story with Challengers last year, and that received no nominations, much to my chagrin. So this is just one of those cases where I'm not going to predict it, but I will be very happy if it gets in. I imagine I'm going to really like this movie. It's about academia and it's directed by him and stars Julia Roberts, who I love. Quick point, Andrew Garfield plays a character named Henrik Gibson, which just makes me think of Ibsen.
There has to be a connection.
Like, what's going on there? And Then Julia Roberts, her character, her name is Alma Olson, and Alma Elson is the Phantom Thread character. So I just, what's going on with these character names? What's happening here? As a fan of Ibsen and Paul Thomas Anderson, I wonder what's going on.
Everyone has these elaborate names, and then Chloe is just Kim.
Kim. I love that she's just Kim. That's the new Zendaya is Michi. Chloe Sevigny is Kim.
And then our last two predicted nominees. You have Sean Penn. I have Benicio del Toro. Is Sean in the trailer at all? Because I think that's what I based off my answer on, is that Benicio was funny and maybe the whole movie is this like really dark comedy satire of sorts. And they're both winners. So I don't know. Talk about Sean Penn.
Yeah, so Sean Penn has two Oscars. He in the trailer is terrifying. So when you watch the trailer again, you'll see this guy who is like super red face, absolutely jacked, white hair. He's so scary. He's
It's
playing
my
a
sleep
character.
paralysis demon.
Yeah, for real. He's playing a character named Colonel Stephen J. Lockjaw, and he is a white supremacist. So this is going to be a villain, a huge villain in the movie. And if we think about recent years too, like Guy Pearce for The Brutalist, Robert De Niro for Killers of the Flower Moon, even if you think about winners, like all the way back to Javier Bardem for No Country for Old Men, they like villains here in supporting, whether they win or not. So I feel like this is going to be a really scary performance.
Okay. Well, is it too much? Is it going too far?
You
Or do
never
they?
know.
Yeah, I think it's borderline, and which is, yeah, terrifying. So we'll see about these two. Let's move on to actress. My predicted nominees. I have Jessie Buckley for Hamnet, Rose Byrne for If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, Jessica Lange for A Long Day's Journey Into Night, Renata Renzve for Sentimental Value, and Tessa Thompson for Hedda.
We have two in common here, Jessie Buckley for Hamnet and Renata Renzve for Sentimental Value. I also have, maybe against my better judgment, Cynthia Erivo for Wicked for Good, Jennifer Lawrence for Die My Love, and Emma Stone for Begonia. So a few we haven't talked about yet. Maybe we start with the big one that we have in common, which is Hamnet. So Jessie Buckley here. Hamnet is Chloe Zhao's next film, and it's based on the novel by Maggie O'Farrell. And even though the book never really goes out of its way to mention Shakespeare, the film is doing so. So in the film, Jessie Buckley is playing Agnes Shakespeare. She actually has the biggest role in the book, so this really is her story. Unless they change it up a bit, it shouldn't really be the story of William Shakespeare, it's really Agnes's story. So I think this could be a big deal for her. She got in for The Lost Daughter, really surprisingly, I think, and she's a pretty big actress on the rise. So I think we can maybe expect to see her here.
Yeah, I hope this is Chloe Zhao back to her roots. I mean, this is obviously a bigger film than Nomadland and not as big as Eternals, but I think it's a great middle ground for a film that could be really praised by voters again. And it's a period piece, it takes you back to Shakespearean times. And along with Jesse, there's Paul Mescal, Joe Alwyn, Emily Watson, and more. So I really think this could do well.
It's giving prestige drama from the 90s, which that's not derogatory coming from me. That's exciting.
I mean, it just really makes me think of Shakespeare in Love and how well that did, and every sort of Shakespearean piece that the Oscars have embraced. And having Chloe Zhao, this is very different, it seems, just to what she's done in the past. So I'm very curious. We have Lucas Zal, the cinematographer. So I think, yeah, with cast and crew, this will be big. It is being distributed by Focus Features in the US and has Steven Spielberg behind it as producer. So I really do think bring on the Oscars. We also mentioned Renata. And I think we've talked about this movie as much as we can for right now. You can speak more about her because you saw the film, but absolutely love her. I want the world for her, and that includes an Oscar nomination and a win. In terms of your other predictions that I just kind of assumed were there, and I wanted to mention other people, Cynthia Erivo, absolutely. Jennifer Lawrence felt like an easy write-in answer for this because of Cannes and what you said about her performance. So maybe talk about Jennifer, Cynthia, and Renata a little bit.
Yeah, so Renata and J-Law, I saw both of their performances in Cannes. I talked about those quite a bit on our Cannes recap episode. Very, very different types of performances, but both, I think, ones that actors will really like. I think Renata's absolutely brilliant in sentimental value, and she would be my pick to win, just if I were voting. But I think what Jennifer Lawrence is doing in Die My Love is probably the best work in her career. She's really pushing herself. It is a lot. The hard thing for her, I think, will just be that I can't really see the film getting in anywhere else, but I think she's the type of actor who can get in on her own, and it's the type of performance that can be a lone representation for a movie. And then again, Cynthia Erivo, same story as with Ariana Grande, honestly. It just really depends how they respond to Wicked for Good, but I'm putting her here because she will also have some new songs, and it'll be a very Elphaba-heavy film, so if she got in last time, maybe that will work again this time.
Yeah, I definitely think it's possible. My other nominees, I have Rose Byrne for a similar reason that we mentioned Andrew Scott. She won lead performance out of Berlin for this movie. And this film was pretty positively reviewed out of Sundance. It sounds like a really tough watch, which that's a red flag in terms of Oscar performances, but she is just handling so much in this movie that I want to see it. I want to see her doing something really bold and dramatic that we haven't seen before. I mean, obviously you think back to Bridesmaids and what a fun actress she can be. So I am looking forward to this. This is being distributed by A24, which I think will help it compared to other smaller festival releases that we want to see do well, but really can't. And it's being produced by Josh Safdie, and it stars Conan O'Brien. He's playing the therapist who she gets into a really hostile relationship with. So again, maybe some comedy, drama, thriller elements there. Yeah, just something different.
I love movies about women unraveling. So Rose Byrne and or Jennifer Lawrence, like these mm-hmm. types of movies and the work that they're being asked to do sounds similar.
I mean, Amy Adams didn't work last year for Night Bitch, but I think that was still a fun performance and we talked about it quite a bit. So I'm still hoping one of these can work.
I want to hear about Jessica Lange in A Long Day's Journey and Tonight. This is our third year of bringing up this performance on this episode.
And that is the only reason why, I think, one of the only reasons why I had to put it in here, because we can't talk about it for so long and then just completely blank the film. Like, sure, put Ed Harris in. I could probably switch him out with somebody later on and the film and who knows. But yeah, we've been talking about it for so long and I feel like it has to happen. Because Jessica Lange is a winner, and the fact that this is such a well-known play. I guess, why didn't you put her in?
I think I just couldn't do it again. If I know it's coming, like when it has a release date specifically.
It does now. It does. What? That's why I had to put it in. I said,
what is the release date?
It came out at the Dublin International Film Festival. I thought I saw a particular date, but it looked confirmed somewhere. And I said, okay, I think they're just ready to put it out finally.
It will be very funny if she wins Best Actress.
Some of these things happen for a reason. My longstanding love of Jessica Lange and Willem Dafoe will pay off.
I'm ready for you when Robert Eggers, they just announced that he's making A Christmas Carol with Willem Dafoe. So I'm ready for you to predict him as Ebenezer Scrooge.
I can't wait.
Whenever that day comes.
I hope it's a remake of the musical 70s version and we can just have Willem Dafoe singing.
The Albert Finney one?
It's so good. Yes.
Oh my God. Amazing. Well, speaking of great stage roles, you also have Tessa Thompson for Hedda. Love
this. This is another one we've kind of been talking about for a while and it keeps getting delayed. They have Hildur Guðnadóttir as the composer. This is also one we've talked about consistently, waiting for its release. It's coming out in October. It's being released by Amazon MGM Studios. It's based on the play Hedda Gabler. And famously, it won multiple Oliviers for Best Revival. It was nominated at the Tonys for Best Actress in 2002. This play has a lot of history, and we know that those adaptations from stage to screen do fairly well. It's a performance I think we've been waiting for since she was talked about and, again, highly praised for her role in Passing. So I'm hoping this one finally comes out and we can talk about it later this year.
Yeah, I love that. My last one, Begonia and Emma Stone. You know, I put her here because when Emma Stone works with Yorgos Lanthimos, she could either win an Oscar or it could go nowhere. And I don't know which one this could be. Like, is it Poor Things or The Favorite or is it Kinds of Kindness? This is written by Will Tracy, who wrote The Menu, and it is a sci-fi comedy satire. So I feel like it could be something, I don't know, like a little bit of Poor Things with a little bit of Triangle of Sadness, which might not work for me, but might work for the Academy. So this is one of Focus Features. They're big players this year. So they have this and Hamnet. So I'm curious which one they will go for. It also has a very awards-friendly October release date. So I think this might go to Venice, maybe to Telluride. So I think we can expect to see it on the festival circuit.
This is what she's been known to shave her head for. But what irks me about this movie is that it really sounds like the second skit from Kinds of Kindness. And so here's a description, which is, again, this movie is based on a South Korean film. And the film is about two conspiracy-obsessed young men who kidnap the high-powered CEO of a major company, convinced that she is an alien intent on destroying planet Earth. So this reminds me of that segment where it was like, is Emma Stone's character an alien or what's happening? And then that happened, which made me want to walk out of a theater. And it just sounds like a bizarre movie to do well at the Oscars. I think maybe it fits for a South Korean film that can be really fun and edgy and weird. But I don't know as much. So I kind of stayed away from Emma Stone in this category, even though exactly what you said, you know, every time they collaborate, it seems to do fairly well.
Yeah, I'm curious to see which way it goes. But next we'll go on to Best Actor. My predicted nominees are Timothy Chalamet for Marty Supreme, Leonardo DiCaprio for One Battle After Another, Dwayne The Rock Johnson for The Smashing Machine, Wagner Moura for The Secret Agent, and Jeremy Allen White for Deliver Me From Nowhere.
So we only have one overlapping, and that is Jeremy Allen White playing Bruce Springsteen. So I think that fits as a biopic performance that could do very well, especially after his Emmy wins over the past few years with The Bear. I also have Ethan Hawke from Blue Moon, the same film from before with Andrew Scott, Oscar Isaac playing Victor Frankenstein in Frankenstein, Paul Mescal in Hamnet, and Michael B. Jordan in Sinners. So adding on to what we talked about before with some of these movies, we are getting into quite a bit of overlap here. So Blue Moon is about the opening of Oklahoma, the musical, and it is about Lauren's Hart's struggles with alcoholism and mental health, and Ethan Hawke is playing Lorenz. So I think that could be a very tricky character, a really good dramatic performance that we've seen him do time and again with any director, be that Richard Linklater or Paul Schrader. This makes me think of The Card Counter or First Reformed, but again, a leading performance. I think this could do fairly well with the Academy. And Oscar Isaac leading the Frankenstein movie, I'm hoping he can pull out something because he, I feel like, is becoming overdue for great performances that he's given us over the years. Lately with Dune, but going back to Inside Llewyn Davis and previously. Paul Mescal, maybe he is more of a supporting actor based on what you said about the book playing William Shakespeare, but playing William Shakespeare, I think has some big potential.
I'm really curious to see what she does with that one, just because if it's straight page to screen, he'll absolutely be in supporting. But who knows? Maybe they could beef up the role a little bit. I mean, I will not complain if I see more Paul Mescal in the movie. But yeah, that's one of those category placement ones that's up in the air right now. I mean, quite a few of these are, honestly. Mm-hmm. But I totally agree with you about Oscar Isaac. I think he is one of those actors who he absolutely should have gotten in for Inside Llewyn Davis. No question. He's so amazing in that movie. And he's just kind of, right on the edge. And Ethan Hawke, too. So I like that you have these people who are just kind of right on the outside, with those two of getting a nomination previously, and I could totally see that happening this year. I mean, I think the one we have in common, Jeremy Allen White, makes sense because it's a biopic performance, and it's just good practice, I think, to bet on a biopic, even if it doesn't pan out. I think they tend to more than they don't. And then I want to ask you about Michael B. Jordan, because this is the first time that we've brought up Sinners, and it will come up again, I think, in our later categories, but I'll say for my list, he was right on the outside. So I think it's very possible.
I'm partially pulling a Bennett here and picking a performance that we have seen and we know mm-hmm. is good and that the movie has done really well and people are still talking about it. So I'm hoping that is something that we see continue to happen, because Michael B. Jordan is not only great, but he's portraying twin brothers, and both characters are so different in their mannerisms and their stories, really, that it is something that he should be recognized for. It's another actor we've talked about over and over. This episode is hard to do for movies we haven't seen and for newer actors or actors who are making their debuts, because we just don't know them yet. And, mm-hmm. part of this is hoping that these people who give us great performances can get recognized. So there are a few reasons that I have him in here, but it's like we talked about on the episode, it was the best movie of the year so far. And it's someone that I'm happy to praise already and hope for.
Yeah. I could also really see him doing well, getting in it, Critics' Choice, SAG, places like that, all places you hope to get in on the road to Oscar. So, but I think you're totally right. Go with a good performance that we already know. We already mm-hmm. know that he's good in the movie and that the movie is great and people are talking about the movie still. So yeah, I think that's a good pick. In a similar vein, I picked Wagner Moura for The Secret Agent, because that's a great performance, very nuanced, layered, reminds me of something from a movie from the 70s. It is a 70s set thriller, but he also won Best Actor at Cannes. So I feel like if this movie really takes off, he could have a spot here. Also, I'm not going to bet against Brazil after last year with Fernando Torres and I'm Still Here. I liked I'm Still Here more than The Secret Agent. I also liked her performance more, but I think he's great in it. And I could see that translating here if the movie really takes off. And the others, I just went with tried and true staples, Leonardo DiCaprio. I know he didn't get in for Killers of the Flower Moon, but he's wanted to work with PTA for a really long time. And I love comedic Leo. I love him in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So I'm thinking he could maybe be recognized again here. And last year, Timothée Chalamet had A Complete Unknown, which did really well with nominations. That didn't translate to any wins, but I think people really loved that movie and it did really well at the box office. And I think we'll see a similar story here with Marty Supreme. He's not playing Bob Dylan, but he could go on SNL again for Marty Supreme for playing Marty Reisman. We'll probably just see, instead of seeing him perform Dylan songs, he's just going to be playing a lot of ping pong all year, which is going to be pretty funny in his new way to Oscar campaign. But I think he could definitely appear again. It'll probably have a good run. And I think, the Timothée Chalamet versus Adrian Brody thing was one thing. People wanted him to break his record and everything. That didn't happen. But Timothy versus Leo. It'll be like the movie star and the heir apparent battling it out. I think could be a very juicy narrative for the trade. So they will totally want to make happen. And you have The Rock. You have Dwayne Johnson transforming in a serious role. Like, I feel like that could also totally happen. I could see him doing a lot of Q&As, potentially getting a tribute somewhere. And it looks like the movie is really anchored on his performance.
And it could come along with an easy makeup and hairstyling nomination. So absolutely. Yeah. So next up, we have Best Director. My nominees here, I have Kathryn Bigelow for a currently untitled Kathryn Bigelow film, James Cameron for Avatar, Fire and Ash, Guillermo del Toro for Frankenstein, Joaquin Trier for Sentimental Value, and Chloe Zhao for Hamnet.
So we just have Trier for Sentimental Value in common. My other predicted nominees are Yorgos Lanthimos for Begonia, Paul Thomas Anderson for One Battle After Another, Kleber Mendoza-Filho for The Secret Agent, and Ryan Coogler for Sinners. Where do we want to start? I mean, I think we can just get Sentimental Value out of the way. This does, you know, just feel like we both really like The Worst Person in the World, and Trier wasn't nominated in director that year for that movie, but he did get a screenplay nomination, and I really think that this movie will be embraced, and I think he will be recognized in director. When I think of Cannes, I think there are really three movies that came out of that festival that made me think, okay, I think we'll be talking about these for a while. The Secret Agent, Sentimental Value, and of course, the Palme d'Or winner, It Was Just an Accident. But I think the difference is that for me, Secret Agent and Sentimental Value have actor potential, maybe screenplay potential, whereas I don't necessarily see that for The Panahi, even though I think that's a wonderful film. So that's why I went with Trier and Kleber Mendoza-Filho here. I just took the two, what I saw to be two of the big international picks from Cannes and just put them here, like we've seen in the past, like with Zone of Interest and Anatomy of a Fall.
Yeah, Jafar Panahi for me, I had in and I took him out for whatever reason. My big thing here, which is mainly a joke, is Kathryn Bigelow and James Cameron having another face-off.
I was going to ask you about this.
Yeah, I mean, do I think Avatar 3 is getting a director nomination? No, not really. So I think my real answer here is Jafar Panahi, because I would much rather not only see him, but I think he deserves it for the films that he's made. But I think having them together again, just like Kathryn Bigelow with this nuclear war White House film and Avatar Fire and Ash, this other expansive film, I feel like is just a funny head-to-head, really.
Yeah, it's funny. When I saw that on the list, I thought, oh my God, I guess it could happen again. But that was just so, so wonderful when she beat him. Oh, yeah. That was just the best. Like, imagine beating your ex-husband at the Oscars. That would be pretty amazing.
I mean, and again, it's a political film versus an Avatar film, which is exactly what happened. This movie is written by Noah Oppenheim, who also wrote Jackie, but he's also the president of NBC News. And it's this political film that unfolds in real time, centered on the White House, as there's an impending missile strike on America. This feels timely, and we know Kathryn Bigelow can make a very impactful film, especially after The Hurt Locker, and that won all of its awards, including Best Picture. There's no official release date, but it's coming. This is Netflix. It has an extensive cast with Rebecca Ferguson, Anthony Ramos, Idris Elba, Willa Fitzgerald. We have to call her out. I'm excited for her. With her movie last year, we loved Strange Darling, and Greta Lee. So I'm looking forward to this one. Hopefully hearing more soon.
Well, I have to ask you why you don't have PTA. Is this to hurt me or to prepare me, or did you just want to be different? Either way, it's okay. I'm just curious.
I should also be asking you about having his movie in every single category today. Is that is that a worse predictor or a better one?
You know, it's true. I think I need to face reality, maybe.
It's not every category, I think, for actress.
But close.
You don't have him out, but I had Teyana. So, yeah, it's not that I don't think this movie's going to happen. Licorice Pizza had its nominations, and he's done well before. I just don't know. It has an earlier release date, I would say, and I'm a little bit more hesitant about, like, late fall than winter, even though this is Warner Brothers' biggest movie, I would say.
I'm just so torn because I don't want to get my hopes up again. I've been on this road so many times of, is this going to be his Oscar? But I don't know. I think this could be the one. I think it's timely. I think it's going to be big. And the director who made the VistaVision film didn't win last year, so let's do it this year.
Well, you have Lanthimos in also.
That's just because I feel like they really like him. And yeah. I don't know what to make of this movie, but speaking of Warner Brothers, I have Ryan Coogler for Sinners. Sinners is complicated because so far, I mean, it's a huge movie. Everyone's still talking about it. We loved it. We talked about how much we really liked it on our episode. I think what's complicated is, can Warner Brothers run two movies? Because when one battle after another comes out, there's a possibility that that could eclipse Sinners because Warner Brothers, they need that movie to make money because it has such a big budget, his biggest budget ever. And I think they're going to just put everything behind it. It also, by nature, like PTA is an 11-time Oscar loser. So I don't know, like maybe they'll just put all their chips behind the PTA movie with Leonardo DiCaprio. But I put Coogler in here because I do think it's a huge directorial achievement. Just listening to him in an interview talk about this film and putting it together, I think it was some of the best directorial choices of any film this year. I could see him getting in. The added complication is that Coogler declined an invitation to join the Academy a few years ago.
Hmm.
And he said that he didn't buy into Oscar season competition. So he's been nominated since as a producer on Judas and the Black Messiah, but that's also as a producer. I wonder if that will actually affect him when it comes down to being nominated for this.
Well, either hopefully people forget that or that doesn't really matter in what they think about, but that could have an effect on it. And if it does, he doesn't care, which is fine. I mean, good for him.
Mm-hmm. It's just one of those interesting things where I just thought, like, could they be petty and hold this against him? I think it comes down to if he will campaign for the movie, too. Mm-hmm. And now on to Best Picture. My predicted nominees are a lot of movies we've talked about already. No surprise. Begonia, Deliver Me From Nowhere, Hamnet, Jay Kelly, Marty Supreme, One Battle After Another, The Secret Agent, Sentimental Value, Sinners, and Wicked for Good.
So we are 6 for 10. I also have Avatar, Fire and Ash, After the Hunt, Ballad of a Small Player, and Frankenstein.
Okay. I think the only one of those movies we haven't talked about at all is Ballad of a Small Player, which is Edward Berger's next movie, his follow-up to Conclave.
Yes, yes. And that's exactly why I put him in. He's 2 for 2 currently, even though this is coming out, feels like more rapid fire with every new movie he makes. There's no reason not to count it out yet. So this is about an English con man who flees Britain for Macau and passes himself off as a runaway lord. It's based on a novel, and it stars Colin Farrell and Tilda Swinton. So I love that pairing. I think Tilda is in a much more supporting role. I'm not entirely sure, but Colin Farrell is definitely in lead. And I almost put him in for actor on this. It's part ghost story, part psychological thriller. So I think that excites both of us. And yeah, with Edward Berger behind it, could he have made it in director? Maybe. And has the same cinematographer as All Quiet on the Western Front, James Friend. So I think this could do really well. Another Netflix film. Again, I so far, they don't have as many as compared to last year. So we'll see if or when that changes. But I think Edward Berger is the big name attached to this that made me put this in.
Yeah, I'm excited to see this. And I mean, anything with Tilda Swinton, I'm obviously very ready for. I don't really know why I left it off today, now that I'm looking back at my list. I think I went too heavy on one battle after another, as you told me.
Well, I'm surprised you left another movie off of this list, Anemone.
Oh, I can't do that. You know I can't. I just, there's only so much my brain and heart can take. So for listeners, if you aren't familiar with Anemone, Anemone is Ronan Day-Lewis's debut and the return of Daniel Day-Lewis to the silver screen. I can't get tied up in this. I just love Daniel Day-Lewis too much, and I'm just excited to see it. It's a first feature, though, so I just don't know. Maybe Indie Spirits. I don't know. But I'm just going to be excited for it and just not think about awards. But would I love another DDL Oscar nomination? Of course. And win? Mm-hmm. Actor? I don't really know who I would go with, so who knows?
With Focus picking it up, I feel like it's bound to be a strong debut. Time will tell, but I'm hoping that it's good for your sake and everybody's. But they do have a few other movies on their list, including The History of Sound, which we haven't mentioned, with Paul Mescal and Josh O'Connor, and also Song Sung Blue, directed by Craig Brewer, with a huge cast, Hugh Jackman, Kate Hudson, Michael Imperioli, too many to name. But this also has a Christmas release. I don't know anything about this.
That's the Neil Diamond one.
Oh.
Another biopic.
Well, there you go. What about some of yours that we didn't overlap with?
So, Begonia, that's just, again, me thinking this is going to be a big push from Focus. It's Yorgos Lanthimos. So, I don't know which direction it could go, but I'm thinking it's going to be more Academy friendly. Deliver Me from Nowhere, I put in because I have two acting nominations. So, that led me to put it in here. But you know what? I'm going to live switch. Going to switch this live, and I'm going to put in Frankenstein. It's going to fit in right there. So we're going to cut out Deliver Me from Nowhere. We're going to put in Frankenstein.
Fun.
Because I think that has a lot of below-the-line potential, and I could see Netflix pushing that one over the line. I think Guillermo del Toro is really loved in the industry, too. So I'm going to put Frankenstein. Then what else do we not align on? The Secret Agent, that's a Cannes one that I think is going to get pushed in, potentially. And then, of course, one battle after another.
Which I think should be here over Avatar. It's the box office potential for that kind of movie that could push it in at the time. Like, if it's making another $1 billion+, it's kind of like Wicked. I mean, Wicked did really well and had a lot of love for it. But at that point, it was like, okay, Wicked has to be in here.
I mean, I wonder, because you have Avatar, Sinners, and Wicked for Good. I wonder if it is just one of them, if it's two of them, how it goes with the big ones.
Yeah, it's some sort of combination. I won't be sad if not everything makes it. It's just kind of taking into account everything that we've seen before. You know, Avatar, The Way of Water had a picture nomination, so I'm just not counting the big things out for now. Mm-hmm. And there are always going to be some sneaky films and nominees that make it in there instead.
Okay, so we're done with our big categories. I think just to wrap up, let's just go through very quickly. Who are your five predicted nominees for our inaugural year with the casting category? We can play these back on our contenders episode.
Probably not. Probably not want to.
Maybe not.
So for mine, I have After the Hunt. The casting director is Jessica Ronan, who worked on Queer, and she was nominated at the Artios Awards. And I thought that was interesting. So just looking at what they nominate and find. So I think with this acting collective, there's some good potential there. Hamnet, I couldn't find a casting director, but again, great cast, potentially lots of nominations. Frankenstein, the casting director is Robin D. Cook. Marty Supreme, the casting director is Jennifer Venditti. And for sentimental value, Ingvild Kolset Haga and Avi Kaufman.
Okay. I have Deliver Me From Nowhere. Casting director is Francine Meisler. Jay Kelly. Casting director is Nina Gold. I also have sentimental value. I'm going way too far in on my heart, I think, with that one. Maybe need to do a little bit of recalibrating. Sinners, also Francine Meisler again. And Wicked for Good, Tiffany Little Canfield and Bernard Telsey.
I think big ones that I didn't pick, yeah, Wicked for Good was first on my list. And I just wanted to mention some other ones. I think with sentimental value, choosing Stellan Skarsgård and Elle Fanning, who don't normally work with Trier, I think is an interesting addition, and especially with their praise, could make it an easy in. The Artios Awards are also separated into lots of different categories, comedy, drama, independent films for those categories too, and then also international. So these could all show up in different ways there and reciprocate at the Oscars. So Yeah, I mean, I like all of our picks. This is obviously very new, and we'll see how this goes.
Yeah, well, that was a lot of fun. I always love this episode every year. We'll see how right or wrong we are in the coming months. But next time on Oscar Wilde, talk about right or wrong. We will be going back in time to a classic Oscar race. We will be doing a 2005 Oscar Rewind. It's been 20 years, and we will be talking all about the Crash versus Brokeback Mountain showdown at the Oscars, and specifically celebrating the 20th anniversary of Ang Lee's Brokeback Mountain. That'll be a good one.
Yeah, and theaters nationwide are playing Brokeback Mountain for this anniversary, and I think it's telling that they all have that and not Crash, at least so far this year. But I'm excited for that. That's one of the biggest Oscar races that we haven't talked about yet on the pod. And yeah, I had fun this episode. Do I feel better about it? No, not necessarily. But I think moving forward, I'm looking forward to some of these movies and hearing about more of them. Absolutely. So thank you all for listening and tuning in. Feel free to rate, review, and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and Blue Sky at Oscar Wilde Pod. And if you really like our show, find bonus content on our Patreon at patreon.com/OscarWilde.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.